Hi, welcome to Offscript. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Today on the show, we're taking a look at Wake Up Dead Man, a Knives Out mystery from Rian Johnson. It comes to Netflix on December 12th, but it is in theaters now. We have seen it. We're looking forward to talking about it. No spoilers if you want to watch it at home. Don't worry about that. We don't do that on this show. We're going to take a look at some upcoming trailers, namely David Lowery's Mother Mary, starring Anne Hathaway. That trailer's out. And this new horror movie called Obsession from Curry Barker, which I believe is Master of Horror Clive Barker's kid. So they've got a movie coming out. We're going to talk about it. We're going to take a quick look at Eternity in our rarefied mailbag segment. So stick around for that. Again, no spoilers in Eternity. We're not about that. And then we're going to take a look at Sentimental Value, the new theme from Joachim Trier. I know that's not how you pronounce it. Joachim. I looked it up before the podcast and I forgot.
Joachim.
Aha. Thank you. Yes. New Norwegian filmmaker's film is out, starring Stellan Skarsgård and Renata Reinsva. I looked her up too. Got it. Is here and Elle Fanning. We took a look at it. We're going to tell you what we thought. Worth the time, just to put it out on front. Before we get to all of it, we need to talk about the news, our first story this week. Popcorn Palooza. At AMC for AMC Stubbs members. That's right. The National Theater Chain is offering half off yearly concession passes with their popcorn pass. That's what it's called. Yeah, it started on Cyber Monday, and it's available to all AMC Stubbs members. Popcorn, right? Free popcorn all year round. Surely that's what's going on here, right?
Sort of. So they're offering this to existing Stubbs members, which... you don't have to be a paying sub member. You can be the bottom tier free pass for $29.99, and you get half off one large singular large popcorn and one refill for all year. This is going to run through December to December, but a lot of caveats attached to it. So you have to go into the movie. You cannot get it to go. You can't do a mobile order. They're being I don't know why they wouldn't let you just pick it up and go, but
yeah,
they're not allowing that. Can't take it home to feed the family. That's basically it. So it's, you get some concessions. I guess it's just the bucket. Oh, you do get a refill. That's the other part. So
yes.
If you frequent AMC a lot, you could save some money if you're scarfing down the popcorn.
Let me give you the math on this, all right? $29.99 for the pass, and you already have to be an AMC Stubbs member. So if you're not one, you got to sign up for the membership. That's a paid membership. They got a couple tiers, but you got to start there. Then you can sign up for the limited time Popcorn Palooza pass here. $29.99 for the pass. So $30, that gives you half off a single large popcorn every day of the year. So if you're going with the family and you're getting two large buckets, tough tomatoes, all right? Only one of them's half off. Like Andy said, you have to buy a ticket. You cannot get it to go. This cannot be a drive-by half-price popcorning. It's got to be in-house, all right? You only get one refill, which is crazy because, dog, you used to get refills for free. So the fact that you got to have a pass to get one is pretty bogus. And lastly, does this all come out to making a profit? Or can you actually turn profit on this? No, you can't. $29.99 a month, $29.99 a year. $30. The average, I looked this up, the average large popcorn price at AMC is around $10 to $12, depending on where you go in the country, right? So you're some small town, nowhere America, $10. You're in LA or New York, $12. So you're saving $5 or $6 per large popcorn. So if you go, you know, five or six times throughout a year, that adds up to $30. You're saving money, right? Everything after that, you're saving. But also, and this is the important thing to remember about the AMC popcorn pass, it's corn and oil, dog. It's just corn and oil. Like, it's just popcorn. It's popcorn, and that is a cheap commodity. It is a very cheap commodity. It is so crazy to me that AMC is offering some, like, Investors Club-style grift pass to try to get you to pay early and pay up front for popcorn you might eat throughout the year. It's nuts, dog. Like, I don't see it. I think this would have had value to me as a consumer if it was half off the whole damn concession stand all year. Then you got a game. And maybe it'd have to cost more than $30. But the average family only goes to the movies like four or five times a year, man. Like, Americans don't go all that often. We go a lot because we do a podcast. And even then, it wouldn't be worth it to me. Like, I don't see it. But AMC Stubbs members seem to be going for it. Seems like a lot of people online are jumping on this thing. Or is that just memes? What do you think, Andy?
Speculative popcorn futures are a funny thing. Yes, like most subscription passes, the idea is to get money up front and not have to wait for the consumer to spend it. So that helps. It sounds like it's for all the concessions. It's definitely just for popcorn and for refills. And it's only once a day. So if you do a double feature, too bad. got to buy a second popcorn tin, drown it in oil. This sounds like a pilot thing. They're going to see how much. I'm sure there's accountants that will show like how much they would need for people to go, and at one point they're losing money. So they're only going to roll this out for a year. They might renew it after that. It's crazy though. Sometimes I see people get food to go from the theater. Like they'll be leaving a movie and pick up a pizza on the way out, and they're like $12 for these like Pizza Hut things. It's crazy.
Dude, I remember way back when I worked at the movies in high school, I worked at an AMC for a few years. And yeah, like the food people would get, it's like a dinner. And that was, you know, that was a couple decades ago, man. It was way cheaper then. Like people still show up to the movies and get big meals. Give me two nachos and three hot dogs and two candies and two large products. Nuts. I know you're feeding the family, but dude, eat before you go to the movie. Don't spend big money, and don't get the popcorn pass. This thing's lame. We could do better. AMC should do better. Adam Aaron should resign. Stranger Things. We gotta talk about the finale. Netflix is putting the finale of Stranger Things season 5 in theaters right at the end of the year. We'd heard a little about this. We have a few more details and a couple of interesting caveats that I think are worth covering, namely how Netflix is making a profit in this thing. Andy, you want to tell the good people at home what this is about?
Says we reported a couple of weeks ago that Netflix would be splitting Stranger Things into several parts. Part one released at Thanksgiving, part two at Christmas, and then the finale on New Year's Eve, New Year's Day, somewhere around there. And that the finale would be released in theater. So they've given us a few more details. That last final episode is a full 2 hours. So it's basically a movie. And they're not actually charging, they're not selling tickets. They're not charging tickets. So there's not going to be any ticket revenue. Instead, theaters will charge you basically a concession ticket to thing. So the theater is earning money, but there's no ticket revenues, which is a really interesting strategy. I think it's just something to drum up PR. More people are going to go because it's essentially a free screening, quote unquote free screening. You're just paying for concessions. It's an interesting strategy. Netflix could care less about the box office revenue at this point, but I'm interested to see how many people will actually get out and go.
Yeah, the first four episodes of Stranger Things Season 5 are currently available if you're not keeping up on Netflix. The next three episodes will drop on December 25th. And like Andy said, the finale comes to Netflix and in theaters on December 31st. I am struggling to see the value on this one. Like, I just feel like it's taken 10 years to make four seasons of a show. And even though Season 5 is just now coming up and it's kind of like the wrap-up, I just don't know how many people care about this. But it's limited release, right? It's only 500 plus theaters. It's not, I don't think AMC and Cinemark are doing it. And you can go to st5finale.com to get instructions on how to RSVP and check out the full list of participating theater locations. I'll just say that's st5finale.com. Finale with an E on the end. I'm not into this. We're definitely not going to cover this for the show. This is not something either of us are into. I don't even think Andy watched season 4 of Stranger Things, which is saying a lot because my man basically heads up TV Corner every week. So, Andy, you want to tell people why you kind of skipped it? Are you at all interested in getting back on the train?
I was really into the very first season of Stranger Things. I remember seeing the trailer and like, oh, this looks great. It's very 80s inspired. And it was. The first season is brilliant. Part of what helped launch the Netflix brand. It's one of their own. It's very, one of their few like really well-known properties because they're not good at launching IPs. I watched season 2. It's fine. I half watched season 3. Season 4 I just skipped. And that was 3 years ago and had no idea what's going on. All these kids are so old. Like it's taken 9 years to produce four seasons of TV, and I think the show is supposed to cover 4 years, basically high school, and all these people look like they have a mortgage and kids now, like they're so much older than the show has been. And there's just so much other great TV. I've actually started my rewatch of the Fallout series, which is coming out a little bit. The season 2 is coming out a little bit later this month.
Oh, nice. I have to catch up on you rewatching Fallout. I haven't heard you getting into that. I don't know how you have the time to watch television like this. I don't know how people have the time to keep up with Stranger Things, especially considering just how long it's taken to get here. But even still, hugely popular. Netflix was just reporting that of the top 10 on Netflix in the past couple weeks, the first four seasons of Stranger Things have all trickled back onto the top 10 as people have been rewatching and getting into this. So obviously it's a big deal over there. As for Netflix, it is wild to me they're not turning a profit on ticket sales. Like they're just letting theaters have it. Seems to be maybe a bit of goodwill Like just a little bit of, hey, thanks for hosting. You guys keep all the concessions. Don't worry about it. Like that's just kind of the angle and good for them. I hope Netflix maybe is starting to turn the corner on working with theaters a little bit more. That wouldn't be evident based on the releases of Frankenstein and Wake Up Dead Man, which we covered previous on the show. And then we'll be covering shortly in regards to Wake Up Dead Man. Stick around for that. But I don't know. Like, it just seems like they don't play nice with theaters. AMC and Cinemark didn't carry either of those films. I don't think AMC and Cinemark are playing with this either. I wish it was better. I wish Netflix movies that were big came to movie theaters and then went on Blu-ray and 4K. And that was just the way it is. This is not really that, but I guess I'm projecting. Yeah. We should talk about Zootopia, I guess, the box office. Yeah. Any other thoughts on Stranger Things here?
No, we can move on to the box office. Crazy, crazy weekend at the box office. A big Thanksgiving weekend, always a big moneymaker for the studios and the theaters. Zootopia opened to $158 million domestic, $556 million globally. Over half $1 billion in its opening. Dude. This is the five-day haul. This is the Thanksgiving weekend holiday. So it's not just the three-day weekend, but it's still huge. Huge one, third biggest opening I think of the year, behind the Minecraft movie and Lilo and Stitch. And also, what's really unique about this is that Zootopia 2 opened to $272 million in China, and the Chinese box office has not been friendly to Western films for quite some time now. It used to be it could rescue your film or be a big hit here and there. Hasn't been that way in a while because of the homegrown films, basically. But apparently Zootopia is pretty big over there. It's Disney has invested in the brand. They have like Zootopia Land in Shanghai, China. And so it's just much more well known. So huge, huge haul from China, $556 million. This is going to be a $1 billion film. One of the biggest films of the year easily.
Yeah. The global reception has been insane. I mean, $500 million in 5 days, dog. That is more money than you and I will ever see in our lives. That is crazy. And off the sequel of like kind of a one-off movie that wasn't really supposed to have any follow-up. I mean, maybe, and now here we are. The numbers out of China are just nuts. You know, I read somewhere that like no matter what kind of story you try to tell in China, eventually it'll always turn into a romance, whether you start as a military drama or a comedy or even some kind of weird twisted horror. Like eventually Chinese audiences love a love story. Like they just come around on it. Like it's a kind of expressive intimacy that maybe they don't get to do a lot in public. And I think, man, Young Rabbit Judy Hopps and Sly Red Fox Nick Wilde are a big game over there, man. They want to see the rabbit and the fox hanging out together, being pals, you know what I mean? And yeah, that there's no better evidence of that than in Shanghai Disney putting in like Zootopia Land or whatever, where you could see photos online of people hanging out with like people dressed up as the bunny and the rabbit. They got a snake in there. I don't know, a bunch of other in. Like I can't even really say what exactly it is, but for some reason, much like I don't know, Nezha 2 or something, like people are just turning out in droves for Zootopia 2. So great, right? That's awesome, dude. Another notch on Disney's bedpost. Ha ha! Like another winning
children's
sequel.
Cinema wins again.
Yeah, that's awesome. I don't really have any plans to see it, but of people I know that have seen it, a couple fans of the show have seen it. Wrote in, thanks for letting us know. It's supposed to be really good. That's kind of the big surprise. Reportedly, the plot is really solid and the script is great. So like, cool. Whenever I do see it, I'll probably enjoy watching it, but I don't know. Yeah, we're coming up on Oscar season, man. I just have not had the bandwidth to take in Zootopia 2.
Yeah, it's interesting because the first film was $20 million film, not very expensive at all, especially by animation standards. Went on to make $70 million in its opening weekend and over $1 billion worldwide. This was in 2016. Or so. I can't believe it's been that long. I thought it was just a few years ago. So crazy numbers for Zootopia, which is known by different property. Apparently it's Zootropolis in the UK and Crazy Animal City in China. So interesting stuff there.
It's a better name. Crazy Animal City is a way better name.
Moving on to the rest of the box office, Wicked for Good came in second with another $62 million, $333 million globally, approaching $400 million. That's a big hit. It's going to continue to rake in. Probably isn't going to have the legs of the first one, but still an impressive haul. Now You See Me, Now You Don't, the third film in the Now You See Me series, had $77 million over the weekend, $186 million worldwide, another big hit. Predator Badlands, $4.8 million. $173 million globally. Best of the franchise, apparently. So we're definitely going to be getting some more of those films. The Running Man rounded out the top five with $3.7 million and $60 million globally. It's good. It's definitely an underperformance, but it's could be a lot worse. And allegedly, Wake Up Dead Man, which was in theaters just briefly, opened to $2.3 million estimated. Netflix doesn't release numbers. They're also not interested in box office haul. They've said this multiple times. But that rounds out the rest of the box office.
Right. If Netflix had a way to just pay the Academy directly for Oscar nomination categorization and didn't have to put movies in theaters, they wouldn't. So this is, you know, good reason to get Knives Out in theaters for a couple of weeks. Wake Up Dead Man, a Knives Out mystery in theaters for a couple of weeks. With that, shoot, I should jump into it. I'm going to be taking the summary on it. So please excuse me, funny delivery. The movie is Wake Up Dead Man, a Knives Out mystery. So, Wake Up Dead Man, A Knives Out Mystery is the third and possibly final entry in Rian Johnson's whodunit mystery series starring Benoit Blanc as Daniel Craig, and Josh O'Connor as a young priest and a former boxer, Pastor Judd, I believe is his name, who, after getting into a dust-up at his local parish, is moved to the small town of Chimney Rock to try to kind of get into a new parish run by a very, very particular persnickety pastor, played by Josh Brolin. Real fire and brimstone kind of guy, right? Josh Brolin coming out real angry, big, mean, got kind of a goofy wig on, and he's assisted there at his local parish by Glenn Close and a host of wonderful locals who are all a bit closed off from the rest of the world, I'll say. But Josh O'Connor's going to come in with his kindness and his kind of new lease on life since he's got out of boxing and try to kind of bring in kindness to this local place. Well, it starts to go okay, but he doesn't really get very far up until our new Monsignor, played by Josh Brolin, is murdered. And in a very mysterious fashion, of course, nobody can solve except for possibly world-renowned detective Benoit Blanc. So when Daniel Craig arrives and put on hot on the case, the police are close behind him, and it's up to Blanc and Pastor Judd to figure out how this happened and who is innocent and who is guilty. It's a classic whodunit, and it's in theaters right now. It's in theaters up through December 12th, then it'll go to Netflix, where I think most people will watch it. And we saw it in theaters. Not going to talk about spoilers, but I'm curious to hear what you think. Andy, what did you think of Wake Up Dead Man?
So there's a lot that works in this and some that doesn't. I think this is a little bit sloppier than his previous two films. It has much different format. The first 40 minutes is kind of preamble where we meet Josh O'Connor's character, Father Judd, and of course Jefferson Wick's Josh Brolin's character. And we get to know the community, that they're in this very small church, and everyone is faithful but also fearful of the Monsignor, that they feel like they can't leave. They want to be just part of the group, and they're kind of afraid to stand up against him. We don't get the murder and the mystery solving doesn't start until Act Two, so pretty late into the movie. And I think my biggest complaint is it's just so long. It's a full 2.5 hours, and I was like, sometimes the pacing's good, sometimes I'm like, where are we going here? So just not as neat and tight as I think the first Knives Out film is a masterpiece, and that movie is just paced really well and it's really tight and you can follow it. I started to get confused after a while. Our cast is huge. I also, our cast is not well used in my opinion. This feels like it was hit by the Netflix budget machete, where the second one, Glass Onion, is this big that they shot out on exotic locales, big sets. Everyone's in a lot of the scenes. And this, it's just much smaller in scope. You're just kind of at this church and a couple of other locations. Our cast is not together very often. Everyone gets very little screen time because of how many people are in the film. And so I think this film really suffers from Netflix doing a bait and switch. They promised you a big budget and then they cut half of it on the way out. So I I overall enjoyed it, but I think it's really flawed in some ways.
I think I'm a little warmer on it than you are. I liked it. But I also like Glass Onion. And I remember Glass Onion coming out and people thinking it was kind of a miss for Johnson. I'm with you. I think Knives Out is probably the best of these three. But I also think they're all special in their own different way. That's like saying Hot Fuzz is the best of Edgar Wright's Cornetto trilogy. And you're like, well, yeah, objectively, but Shaun of the Dead rocks. Like, and World's End has some good bits in it. And like, I think this kind of follows in that vein. Not that this is like his World's End. This is not the lowest of the trilogy. I don't think that's what's going on here. But I would probably put this on par with something like Onion. I think Knives Out is just special. And it just stands out in a way. I was fortunate to rewatch it just a couple days before going to see this. And like, God, that movie hits so good. But Wake Up Dead Man is different, right? It is not quite like either of those movies. If it's closer to one of them than the other, it's a bit closer to Knives Out. It's like spring. It's got elements, like a lot of it's framed kind of around Easter and Good Friday and Palm Sunday. This idea of resurrection and kind of things coming back is obviously prevalent. But I also agree. I think you're right on the time. It's just too damn long. It's 2.5 hours and it's a procedural, which means you, the adult, already are kind of familiar with the procedure and you're expecting a few things to happen in the first like half hour where you're like, all right, let's get to it. You know, Glass Onion gets to the goods pretty quick and then resets back. That's part of the gimmick of that movie. And I remember people being frustrated with that structure. This doesn't quite do that. But it just takes a while to get where it's going, and come act two, it gets a little messy. It gets a little confusing. Is it maybe one too many suspects? So let's review. I don't want people to think that I think this is a bad time. I don't. I actually had a lot of fun with this movie, but let's just really quickly look at our cast. We've got Daniel Craig as Benoit Blanc. Josh O'Connor as Pastor Judd, Reverend Judd. Glenn Close as our local kind of assistant at the church. She kind of takes care of everything. Black clad nun reminded me a lot of Doubt, that movie, 2008 movie starring Philip Seymour Hoffman and I don't remember her name. Josh Brolin, Monsignor Jefferson Wicks, Meryl Streep. Thank you, Jefferson Wicks. Mila Kunis as the local sheriff, and then a host of local parishioners: Jeremy Renner, Kerry Washington, Andrew Scott, Kaylee Spaney, Daryl McCormick, Thomas Hayden Church. Jeffrey Wright appears in this film. Pretty solid upfront cast. Everybody's a good time. I think your real special standouts go to Josh O'Connor as Judd, Glenn Close, who is just having a great time in this movie, dude. Her and Johnson were cutting it up apparently behind the scenes because they are just having the time of their lives. Blanc is a delight. And I really like Josh Brolin. Josh Brolin's worth it. Also, Kerry Washington burns the screen up, dude. She only gets a few really big scenes where she has a lot of dialogue because she's one of a cast of characters here. But like, dude, Kerry Washington rocks.
So we were talking about a couple of weeks ago, whenever the Conjuring movies Last Rites came up, that like actors get more expensive the more they're in a franchise because they demand more money as it continues to be successful. And you really feel that here because Daniel Craig basically isn't in Act One. He doesn't show up till Act Two, really. And so Josh O'Connor is largely the main character. They kind of share screen time. And again, Daniel Craig is incredibly expensive these days because he was James Bond for so long. It demands a huge payday. And again, you can feel the budget kind of clamping down. And again, we have a great cast of characters, but they don't necessarily interact a whole lot. There's very few scenes with all of them together. You might get pockets of people. They just don't have as much personality as they've kind of had in the past. Mila Kunis, particularly, she's the local sheriff. She's just standing for the audience, and she just is wasted because she's the one who comes in and she's like, hey, can someone explain what's going on? Can someone tell me? Like, she's a stand-in, so someone has to explain something to the audience. She's not really used very well. Kaylee Spaney, also, she's a parishioner who is suffering from medical ailments and has donated a lot of money to the church in hopes of a miracle, basically. Also kind of wasted. Thomas Hayden Church, there's almost too many people, and they don't really get enough screen time. So there are... all the performances are still pretty strong. Jeremy Renner as the doctor, I think this is one of his first major films since his snow plowing accident. He nearly died a couple of years ago, was run over by a snowplow. I mean, you can see visible scarring on like his face and neck. Like he's had a long road to recovery. So I think our cast is fun. They're just not as fun as they've been in past films, because I think the budget kind of got clamped down. Where I think this does, or how it's similar to past films in, that Johnson has done, is a kind of social commentary, which he brings up in the these whodunits. In this one, he has a lot to say about religion and religion's place within society, because he paints Daniel Craig, Benoit Blanc, as kind of the staunch atheist, and then Josh O'Connor as a man of faith. And they're working together, and they're not butting heads, even though they have very different beliefs. And he has a lot to say about how religion is used and currently being used in our country, and where it does and how it does belong and has a place. He's not someone who's like, this doesn't have a place in modern society. I believe he thinks it does, but he's touching on a lot of current socio-political issues like he does in all of these whodunit movies.
Yeah, that's honestly probably the best part of it. It's kind of the overarching theme of religion versus belief versus non-belief. And I think he does a really great job of cleaving belief in half with Judd and Wicks, right? Like Pastor Judd is this young kid coming in who's like just wants to do good and wants to bring the gospel message of like bounty and harvest, right? Of like, hey, good times are coming. There's a lot to be depressed about and negative about in the world, but if we work together and like we work for one another in love and friendship, like we can get along. But Monsieur Wicks, who already runs like the place, is so not that way. He is fire and brimstone. And people are almost leaving on the daily, the church, because they can't take like the personal attacks. He's up there screaming at people about how everything's burning down because he's acting out of anger, and that anger is rooted in fear that his way of life and that his way of beliefs are going away, that modernity is ruining these things, right? Having a cell phone and social media. Meanwhile, he's using these things, YouTube namely, to put his message out online through one of his parishioners who's recording him. They got a little account, and he's like a hot right-wing pastor who's up there screaming about problems every week. So like when this guy makes a quick exit in early in the film and there's suddenly questions about it, and the young pastor who's come in is kind of suspect numero uno, you've got an immediate motive. Well, of course, they believe something totally differently about how our church should be run. And that is a perfect time for Benoit Blanc to show up and give this really great monologue about being a heretic, how I don't believe in any of this stuff. Hilariously, our police chief, played by Mila Kunis, has a little plaque on her office desk that says, Shalom, y'all. Like, and she never goes to church, which makes it very obvious that like she's not really into what they're doing either. But you're right. She definitely plays, she reminded me a lot of Lakeith Stanfield in Knives Out. Like the investigator character who's grounded in reality, who's like, can somebody tell me what the hell's going on so I know who to arrest? Because I can't make heads or tails of what's happening here. Like, she's definitely that. I agree, it's too complicated. I think you could cut, yeah, I don't know, a half hour out of this movie, cut a few characters, tighten some things up. As far as the core mystery goes, solid. I didn't see where it was going, though I did have some suspicions along the way. I think you're supposed to. It's a whodunit. Overall, I think it accomplishes what it needs to, and I do think people would like it more than Glass Onion, who didn't, because Glass Onion was a bit non-traditional, and this kind of fits a bit more into what I think people expect from a whodunit. I like it. I don't think it's not the high watermark of the series, but it's not a low either. I don't know. I think you put it right in the middle. And most importantly, I'm really glad that they're not wrapping this up. They're not doing press like, this is the final Knives Out movie. We're never making another one. Johnson and Craig have both said they want to do more of these. They're going to take a break. Johnson has done three of these in a row. He's now working on a new original script, which I'm excited to watch. So like, I don't know. I think this is a harmless entry in the Knives Out series. That's what I think.
Yeah, I wanted to comment on plot a little bit, where, yeah, there's definitely too much going on. And what happens in a lot of these movies is that there's the murder, and then during the investigation and solving of it, even more things develop, you know, more things are unearthed about our characters and secrets, and additional mysteries have to be solved along the way. This does that as well. It just kind of gets too convoluted. Again, there's too many characters, and you have a hard time keeping straight. Like, I felt like I needed to start taking notes, be like, okay, where's that guy? Would definitely improve on rewatch. But the main murder mystery works pretty well and fun. Josh Brolin he's a highlight of this as well. He's seen stealing in as this fire and brimstone preacher. He's really good. Like I said, it seems smaller than the previous entries, not as tight. At the same time, Netflix let him do what he wanted, but they were also like, we're cutting the budget on this. We can only have Daniel Craig for so many days. Like, we got to cut this down.
Yeah. Well, what are you going to do? Overall, I don't know. I guess we should get to recommendations. Andy, would you recommend Wake Up Dead Man?
I'd recommend it to fans of the series. If you like the other two Knives Out films, you'll probably enjoy this. It's going to be on Netflix on December 12th. We caught it in theaters early. So watch it with your family. It is one of those things. It's family fun. There's not a lot of like violence or any or sex or anything like that in the film. Sit down, watch it with your mom and dad. It is a little overly long at 2.5 hours. It could have cut some of that. Really strong performances overall. It's got some interesting things to say about sociopolitical things going on in the country right now, about religion and things like that. So I would say soft recommend.
I'm a bit more of a hard recommend. I think it's a fun time. I think if you're a whodunit fan, it's complicated. I do think it feels like Johnson felt like he had to clear his two previous entries even bigger this time. Like, I got to do it bigger and better. And yeah, the movie's got to be a little longer and the case has to be a little bit more complex. And I think that kind of hurts it, but I can't blame him. I think it's a really solid entry in the franchise. Would recommend. I think it's a good time. Go see it in a theater if you can. God, don't just watch it on Netflix and feel like it was lame, right? Like, go commit. It plays great in the theater. It's very theatrical. Yeah, that's Wake Up Dead Man. We got a couple trailers to talk about, Andy. What do we call this segment?
It's time for the trailer park. So we just have a couple of quick trailers. These trailers just came out today, so hot off the press. The first is called Mother Mary. This is the new film by David Lowery, who, of course, did The Green Knight, which we're big fans of here, A Ghost Story. Big fan of his work. I have a tattoo from The Green Knight. Mother Mary stars Anne Hathaway as a famous pop star who needs a dress. She and no one will work with her for reasons unknown, and she seeks out her old stylist, played by Michaela Cole, comes to her and says, I gotta have you back. We gotta work together again. And she says, oh, I knew you'd be back. I could see you coming 1,000 miles away. Now, this is the basic premise, but things get real weird where it looks like it might take a turn for the supernatural. Who knows if you're gonna survive. The trailer is great because it's saying this is not a love story, this is not a hate story, a ghost story, this is a communion, a prayer. This looks like it's gonna get real weird. Like, this relationship with these two people is like, people aren't gonna survive. It's gonna be great. Hunter Schafer is also in this. David Lowery, as we know, because we got to see a Q&A with him, really bit of a dark guy, very nihilistic, and that usually shows up in his films as well. Anne Hathaway looks stunning in this. I'm super excited. This is coming out spring 2026.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this. I don't know what to expect. You know, when we talked to David, well, when we heard from David Lowery at a Green Knight Q&A he did here at the Historic Texas Theater in Dallas, he talked about shooting A Ghost Story with Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara, and he talked about how he shot that movie and didn't know what to do with the footage and had thought about just kind of scrapping it. Like, he couldn't work out a good edit that he liked. Now, obviously, we know that worked out and came out and went to festivals and did really well, and it was different and emergent, and it was good stuff. From there, he started working with Disney. He did a Peach Dragon live-action remake that was really successful, and people say is straight gas. I haven't seen it, but like, it's on Disney Plus. Go check it out if you'd like. I hear it's really good. He did Green Knight. Then he went out to the Netherlands and shot Peter Pan and Wendy. Yeah. And then it's been quiet, and he's been shooting this. And I heard that apparently in another Q&A, he kind of echoed the same sentiment about Ghost Story. Apparently, he shot a lot of this, and it kind of hasn't really known what to do with it. And watching the trailer, you can see it does look like it goes somewhere strange. I don't know where exactly, but it looks like it gets very surreal. Things start to get nuts. I love that it has echoes of Black Swan, the Darren Aronofsky film, right? Yep. I love that it reminded me of Incredibles, when Mr. Incredible needs a new suit. So he goes, hits up Edna, and he's like the weird freak costume designer who's like, I'm going to make, and she's like a little shorter than him, I'm going to make you put something perfect, darling. It's going to be great. Like, I don't know. I don't know what exactly is going on in Mother Mary, but like, I'm here for it. I love the trailer only cites Green Knight. It's just like, listen, there's only one movie you got to know about. It's the guy who made that movie, and this is going to be cool. So check it out. When does Mother Mary come out?
Spring 2026. We don't have an exact date just yet.
All right, one more to talk about on the trailer park this week, then we'll talk about Eternity. We're going to talk about the trailer for Obsession. This dropped just today, and this is a new horror film from Curry Barker, child of Clive Barker, written and directed by Curry. This is a simple trailer. It's really a teaser. It's a push-in on what looks like a stressed young man who's sitting in the driver's seat of a car as he's talking on the phone to some kind of customer service rep, and he's asking whether or not his wish is actually come true. Has this woman who has fallen in love with him, is she really in love with him, or is it maybe not that? As he kind of starts to have this conversation with this dark, booming voice, it starts to come out that things are not quite as this kid may have wanted. You see flashes of this this special little almost novelty Christmas toy box, like something you'd see an old harmonica, and it's labeled the One Wish Willow. And on the back of it, there's some instructions. You take out the One Wish Willow, you snap, you think of your wish, you take a deep breath, you snap it in half, and then you wait 24 hours. And after 24 hours, that thing comes true. And it's obvious that our boy has somebody who he maybe has wished to love him in a way, and now this has gone south. This premiered, I think, at Toronto International Film Festival, or some kind of festival, because people are talking online about having already seen it. Reviews seem mixed. I don't know a lot about it. Andy, what do you think of the trailer for Obsession?
Man, this really creeped me out. I didn't know what this was. I saw it a little bit talked about on film Twitter, so I checked out the trailer. And it's real effective. It's a bit of a monkey's paw situation is what it looks like. Young man wishes for his crush to love him back, and there's some problems, but we're not told what these problems are. It's just like he's calling the 1-800 customer service number, and he's like, hey, there's, you know, can I alter this a little bit? There's kind of an issue. And they're just like, nope, you get what you get, man. Like it's like a real customer service situation, but it's clear that his wish has not gone completely the way he would want it to. Nothing is revealed past that. We'll probably get a trailer another month or so. This comes out May 15th. I mean, that's a hot summer date. So maybe there's more to this than we know, but it creeped me out, and I'm definitely looking forward to it.
Yeah, Monkey's Paw is a perfect way to describe it. I was rewatching old episodes of the Canadian children's television show Goosebumps leading up to Halloween. There's one episode that is exactly this plot. It's like a young girl who like wishes the popular girl at school would like her. So she makes a Monkey's Paw wish with some weird witch or something. And the next day, like the girl is at her house and she's in her closet when she's sleeping. And like, you cannot get away from this person. So like, I don't know. Obsession could be hot. Keep it hearing off script for more. Really quick, before we jump into our review for Sentimental Value, I promised at the open we were going to talk about something special this week. So here's what I got for you. I'm just going to lay it out. I have a review for Eternity, that new rom-com starring Miles Teller and Elizabeth Olsen and Callum Turner, Divine Joy Randolph, John Early. But I haven't seen it, and Andy hasn't seen it either. So this is a mailbag review, which I don't know if we've ever done on the show formally. What happened was while Andy and I went and saw Sentimental Value on Saturday on the other side of town, because we had to go to some freak theater like an hour away. That was pretty nice. Christine, my lovely wife, went and saw Eternity with her book club friends here in town. And when we got back, I got back to the house, we compared notes, and it turned out she really liked it. I didn't think she would, but she totally went for it. She wasn't sure she would either. She said it's really sweet. So she wrote up a little one page, all right, submitted it to the show. I gave it a read, and after some thorough review and a whole lot of red penning, I'm happy to tell you that I have a quick review for Eternity. So I'm going to read it. We're going to talk about it a little bit, and we're going to move on to Sentiment of Value. Super easy. Here it is. This is my review for, or I should say Chris's review for Eternity. So, in David Frayn's Eternity, the latest from A24, we follow Larry, played by Miles Teller, as he finds out he's died and arrived in a purgatory-esque giant hotel lobby, where he's told by Anna, played by the immaculate Divine Joy Randolph, a worker in this purgatory, that he has 1 week to choose his eternity, a paradise of his own choosing, where he'll have to spend the rest of eternity in. Larry doesn't want to do it yet because he knows that his wife, Joan, played by Elizabeth Olsen, isn't dead yet, and he wants to spend eternity wherever she wants to. And just as Larry thinks he's kind of decided on what to do, Joan joins him in purgatory, but before he can explain anything, another worker, played by John Early, directs Joan's attention to a mysterious man across the lobby. This mysterious man is none other than Joan's first husband, Luke, played by Callum Turner, who died in war when he and Joan were young. So now, Joan has to make the impossible decision to spend eternity eternity with her husband of 65 years, or the man who's waited in purgatory for 67 years for Joan to finally show up. So Chris shared some thoughts on this. I can dig into it, I suppose, or Andy and I can take a second and talk about why we didn't watch this for the podcast, at least yet. I think for me, at least, it's coming up on award season, man, and there's a lot of stuff to see. And I don't know, between Sentimental Value, which we'd already bought tickets for, and Wake Up Dead Man, which we'd already bought tickets for, it just seemed like that was enough for us. Andy, any interest in turning this into a date movie?
It's definitely exactly for that. It's a movie for adults, for couples of all kinds. It's a rom-com. It's got a great premise. It's got beautiful, pretty people in it. The great Davon Joy Randolph. Sorry,
yeah,
is also an Oscar winner that we love from the Holdovers.
Yeah,
yeah. This looks like a great daytime. It is a little long. It's just under 2 hours, which seems like a long time for this kind of film.
Well, here's her thoughts on it. Let me give you the goods here. Quote, to tell you all the truth, the only thing I knew about this movie going in was that it was about a woman who has to decide which of her husband she will spend eternity with. I had not watched a single trailer. I had no idea who was in it besides Elizabeth Olsen, and I loved every second. Eternity was incredibly funny and lighthearted, even while handling some big themes on love and life do-overs. The setting and world-building rules were laid out well without making the audience feel dumb, mainly because Larry gets the lowdown and acts as the audience is kind of view into the world of this purgatory and eternity. While the film does move a little slow in the second act, at no time was I disinterested in what was happening. In fact, the writing is incredibly witty and all of our cast deliver the lines perfectly. It's refreshing to see another rom-com come out of the brilliant minds that A24 gathers. Oh, that's sweet. My standout cast was Divine Joy Randolph, who stole every scene she was a part of. I think that I audibly gasped when she showed up on screen for the first time, knew I was in for a delightful time as I realized how amazing the chemistry between her and specifically Miles Teller were. She said, we need to get these two in another comedy or romance or something. They're both great. On the other hand, she said Callum Turner's a little weak, as I think he plays the perfect husband who died at war, but he's probably the weakest casting choice. He and Miles Teller are fine, but I was opposed to everyone else in their chemistry. His is a little lacking. Good, but not quite the same as everybody else. But she said, overall, Eternity is a must-see for everyone, but especially couples who've been in a relationship for a long time. Don't go in thinking you're just going to watch a silly Hallmark romance unfold. Eternity will have you laughing one second and crying the next and having a bit of an existential crisis raised by thought-provoking discussions and questions afterward. Trust me, it's totally worth it, and I'll definitely be dragging Zach to see it as soon as I can. Oh, that's sweet. Yeah, it sounds like it's a bit of an everything movie, right? It's funny, it's a heartbreaker, it's sweet, it makes you think about the life you're living and who you're spending your time with. Not too shabby. And I was surprised that she hadn't seen a trailer for it, but yeah, she went in totally blind, which I think is the best way to see one of these movies. If I do see Eternity, and it sounds like I will at some point, one of the things I really want to keep an eye out for is the setting. This kind of hotel lobby, like purgatory kind of setting is always interesting. It's something I was really looking out for in A Big, Bold, Beautiful Journey when I saw that movie. That was, you know, kind of a big, fantastic, bombastic rom-com that goes to fantasy places. And like, you never know how that's going to work in cinema, like how that's going to come off. But like a lot of good set design and some clever direction, you can get really creative, you know, spaces to play in where a movie where you got to do a whole lot of acting, something like Eternity, really shines. So glad the chemistry works good. Andy, any interest in seeing this one?
Not a whole lot, but it's good to know that it's more than the premise. Like, because this looks like a 90-minute like rom-com, like silly fun time, but it looks like there's probably more. And I'd be interested to see what the difference is between the book, because it's based on a book, correct? Yeah, that's right. It's book club. Between yes. The book and the film are, and because yeah, a lot of times films get dumbed down, unfortunately, for audiences. So I'd be interested to see what those like themes and story elements are in the novel.
Yeah, me too. So thanks for writing in, Chris. Shoot, I really appreciate it. And I think if anybody else wants to write in reviews, I think I'm open to that. Not to encourage you all, but just saying, if somebody else has seen something we haven't seen, mail at offscriptfilmreview.com. Write in the show, tell us about it. And whenever I do get around to seeing Eternity, I'll report back here as soon as I can. That's Eternity. One more movie to talk about on the podcast. Andy's going to be taking the summer on this, so I will get out of his way. Andy, please take it away.
Sentimental Value. So this is a long-awaited film that we've been really excited to see. This was a big hit at the Cannes Film Festival, came in, got the second place prize, the Grand Prix. Been hearing a lot about this all for the last 6 months. This is the follow-up from Norwegian director Joachim Trier. He previously did The Worst Person in the World, which we haven't seen yet on the show. Heard it's great. I'll get around to it sometime. This stars the great Renata Reintsev, who was in... Ryan Spey, who was in that previous film, also Stellan Skarsgård, and more. She plays an actress estranged from her father. Stellan Skarsgård is this once famous and well-known, well-revered director who's in the twilight of his years, hasn't made a film in a long time, and is also estranged from his daughters. He's written a new script, and he's got an idea, and he's got a hot young actress on board with it, the great Rachel Kemp, played by Elle Fanning, who's having a great year. We just saw her in Predator Badlands as well. He's looking to reconnect with his daughters in their childhood home, which he still owns. He wants to shoot this very personal thing in their childhood home, and he wants his daughter Nora, who is a professional actor herself, to play his mother, basically, which is a little strange. And she's not on board with it. She's like, you have been absent from our lives basically all your life. Now you want to come in and play father. She's not having it. Same thing with her sister Agnes, played by Inga Ibsdotter. Daughter Lilaeus, who's great in this film as well. They're not getting along. It's not really happening. That's where Elle Fanning's coming in, who's a great actress, but not really cast right in. Like, she's an actress playing the wrong actress for this role. It's an interesting, like, movie inside a movie. So it's a family drama about a lot of things, about reconciliation. It's funny. It's got some dark humor, a lot going on. It's pretty complicated. It's been the talk of the season, festival wise. So Zach, what do you think?
I think Sentimental Value is, it's a really good movie. I think it's a lot of fun. It's an acting showcase, right? It is one of those talking head movies where, like, there's very little action pretty much ever. It's think of like Conclave, right? Like Edward Berger's last feature, like before Ballad of a Small Player. That's like very simple. It's like you get some ornate settings because our characters work in theater and film, and that's kind of cool. And a lot of commentary on that and technology and where we're headed in storytelling, but also very much to say about how we tell stories, how we communicate with one another in our families, how we talk about each other across time, how we talk about our parents and our parents' parents, you know, and their struggles. And so much of this is grounded in, at the very beginning of the movie, like a wonderful house. We love a good house movie, right? And our movie opens with this wonderful, like kind of poetic rundown of this house that this family lives in that they've had for years, that their dad's dad owned and their dad's dad owned it. And how this house is a part of nature and a part of time and all this wonderful foliage that's grown up and around it. And then we kind of zoom in through, we blast through the childhood of these two girls, and we arrive at their adulthood when dad comes back from his most recent documentary shoot or whatever. And he's just so disconnected from them. And that's such a fertile seedbed for him to approach his oldest daughter and say, I want you to be a star in my next movie. And she says, I'm not doing that. You and I have nothing in common, and I can't stand you, and I can't be in the same room as you. They both have so much pain, and they both have such similarities to one another, even though these come from totally different places. Much of her pain is attributed to her. Much of his pain is attributed to his parent. So when he wants to make this project that sees these cycles of peoplehood and these like cycles of trauma and miscommunication with her, it sets up such a great space for somebody to May December her and come in and be like, I'm going to follow you around with a notepad and try to do everything you do. It's not quite that. It's a little bit cleaner, but for what it's worth, like, I had a lot of fun with this movie. It's long, but it's good, man. It's very adult. It's a very adult feature. It's PG-13, but like no 13-year-old is going to get what's going on here. Like this is a movie, movie for adults, adult movie.
Yeah. It's what I call it's a bit of a homework movie. It's eating your vegetables. It's slow. It's a little tough to get through, but on the other side of it, it's fascinating discussion and conversation. So part of the reason they're so estranged is that Stellan Skarsgård plays this director who was a hot shot, and he was an absentee father. He was off being a hot director, dating young actresses, which you still see him. He's got a little bit of that womanizing still in him. And it's interesting because he is definitely that kind of patriarchal, like playboy type figure. And what's interesting is that while he was living up that high life, you know, 20, 30 years ago, now it's just kind of sad. And there's been a price to pay. The price is he's estranged from both of his daughters. Neither of them, he gets along a little bit better with Agnes than he does from Nora, but he's still not on great terms with either of them. And when he tries to come back in their lives, he's so inept at relationships. He's not really making things any better. Renata Reinsvay, I want to make sure I get her name right.
I know, I keep saying it wrong.
She's a professional actress, but she's also she struggles with deep depression and anxiety. It's a very funny opening scene where she's about to go on stage because she's a theater actress, and she keeps like delaying. She's like, no, I can't do it. I can't do it. And all the stagehands are like trying to force her to get on the stage. It's a great opener. That's juxtaposed with Agnes, who's kind of a more... who's living a more traditional life. She's married. She has a young child of her own. And again, this is about breaking cycles of not violence, but of like toxic parenting. But she also has her own pain. And what's interesting about this is that there's no one main character. It's not Nora's film. It's not Agnes. It's not Gustav. They all kind of get a lot of screen time, and it's almost like an ensemble thing going on. And thrown into the mix is the great Elle Fanning trying to figure out how to play this mother character, interviewing the daughters who hate the father and live and come into the house and trying to get a feel for it. There's also a part where she thinks she needs to do it in a Norwegian accent and she really can't do it. It's really funny. So it's, we have really great acting performances.
Yeah, Elle Fanning is awesome in this movie. I like her a lot because she is effectively miscast. Our lead, Stellan Skarsgård, makes it very clear in the open that like my daughter is the only person who can play this role. But then he settles, right? Like he's trying to get this movie made and he needs financing, but he can't find it, so he goes with Netflix. And there's a great couple Netflix gags in here about, oh, it's going to go to theaters, and his agent's like, ah, hold on, we might day and date actually. Hold on a second, that's not, you know. And he needs this wonderful theater actress and his daughter, but he can't get her. Okay, so I'll go with this up-and-comer who's blonde, but she can dye her hair and it'll work. And yeah, she's English. She doesn't speak Norwegian, but we'll shoot it in English. It's fine. Like, as an artist, he starts to let himself cut all these corners. Like, he starts to allow his project to not be his and turn into something different. And like, that's where he starts to go wrong. And this butts heads with his daughter, who is a theater actress. I love that she's a theater actress, by the way, that her father works in film, a very modern technology, and she works in an older medium, but she's working in progressive theater. This is like theater all on a black, it's like Hamlet all on a black stage in modern clothes. You know what I mean? That kind of stuff. It's like, it's got electronic music and strobe lights theater. It's like interpretive postmodern theater. Meanwhile, he's making like old documentary stuff. Like you just see these parallels between the two of them. And yeah, that's not to include Agnes, the younger sister, who is like just trying to keep things cool between dad and her older sister, right? Like she had starred in dad's film when she was younger, and her son looks a lot like dad used to, and they connect because the son's got a phone. Like you just see these like connections of people and technology across time, and so much of that comes out in storytelling. And I think Trier does a really, really fantastic job of presenting that in his own film, right? Ultimately, you have to make a film about all this filmmaking. It's a movie, a little bit about movie making and about producing art. And man, I love the way he shoots Skarsgård's footage, like of his like in-universe films in here. He's got a couple of like brilliant oners. And they even talk about shooting a oner at the end of this. Oh, we should shoot a handheld or dolly. Like you get a lot of technical talk in here, which is really cool. Like if you like making movies, this is a movie for you. Like, and that helps me, who's somebody who's into this, like just fall right into the sweet spot of like storytelling and drama in this movie. One thing I didn't expect, I don't know, it seems like a boiler pot. It seems like eventually this is going to end in a huge fight. You know what I mean? But it's not really ramping up to that tension. That's not really what sentimental value is trying to do. And that fascinates me.
Yeah, I expected there to be a big Sissy Spacek smashing a plate scene. That's from In the Bedroom, which is like over 25 years old now. Great scene where Sissy Spacek just big argument, smashes a plate. And we don't really get one of those moments because our characters have such a hard time even being in the same room with each other, much less communicating and trying to resolve and reconcile differences and past grievances, but they do start heading in a way through art, essentially, to find some sort of reconciliation. Some other things I really enjoyed is very much about the passage of time. We find Gustav in, he's 70. He was a big famed director. Now he's in his twilight years, and he's really sensing the passage of time. All his friends are old. He's working with Netflix. Like, he's confused by not, you know, the theatrical model so different. And again, he's trying to kind of assert some of these older like patriarchal values, where he tells Nora, well, you know, when my wife was your age, she had two kids, all this stuff. But he's such a man out of time at this point. Like, his daughters are very modern women, but he's starting to really feel this. Like I said, he goes to one of his old cinematographers to shoot the film, and he's like, yeah, we got to get you back. And then he realizes his cinematographer is old and retired and largely immobile, and he's like, oh, he's not gonna be able to do this. Like, he starts to really feel that. And again, this house is old, it's changed hands. Really interesting stuff. Go ahead, Zach, I got one more thing after you.
No, yeah. Only other thoughts were, I think it's a little long, I'll be honest. Like, it is pretty dry. So it's, you're going to have to sit in for the long haul. If you're watching at home, you may be tempted to hop on your phone or something. But for what it's worth, like, I really enjoyed seeing this in the theater. Like, big presentation. It's a slow burn sort of movie, but that's exactly who you've got on screen, right? Skarsgård is just burning on the screen. Like, he is an asshole when he needs to be, and he's a hurt young man when he needs to be, who's inside the body of a 70-year-old who just can't hang anymore. You know what I mean? Is like taking heartburn medication and knows that the time is nigh, like that he has had this great adventure and that it's behind him now, and he sees these two wonderful girls at home that he just can't connect to, and he thinks, God, like, he's somebody who's full of regret. He's somebody who wants to try to prove to the world he's got one more in him. Renee Reinsveld is like depressed, like deeply depressed, and like cannot get her life together and cannot make a connection and wants so bad to have a family and can't get one. Agnes seemingly has a family, but she's not happy. Like, she doesn't have what she wants. So like the three of them, I don't know, like turn into this wonderful trio of a cast. Like, you get this even really cool like montage shot thing with lights on their faces at the end. Like, I don't know, there's a lot of special going on in this movie, and while I haven't seen any other of Trier's work, I gotta check out Worst Person in the World, because that got a lot of festival attention a couple years ago, and this is a really good time.
I wanted to mention, there's a couple of off-screen characters that are really impactful. The whole thing started because their mother has passed away, and that's how they start clearing out the house and things like that. But also, their grandmother's a very important character, where we learn that she was part of anti-Nazi propaganda and was eventually arrested and tortured by secret police. It's like there's some really kind of dark stuff, which brings up these, you know, kind of some dark stuff in Norway's history, or Sweden. I can't remember which country we're in exactly. Up there, that's also a very important thing. These looming figures of people that aren't in the picture, but that were very much a big part of their development and growing up and things like that.
IndieWire called Sentimental Value a transcending moving masterpiece. I got to know, Andy, would you recommend Sentimental Value?
Yeah, I absolutely would. It's one of the best films of the year. A lot of talk is definitely going to be in the awards chatter, Best Picture, some acting noms, writing, things like that. It is long. It is slow. It's an intense family drama, so it's a very mature film in that way, but we get great performances by our cast, Renata Reinsvej, Stellan Skarsgård, Elle Fanning, and more. It's a great film, but you got to be disciplined when you sit down and watch it.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I think this movie rocks. Keep an eye out for this on top 10 lists. It may not crack top 5, but for somebody out there, it's going to be a real special connection for the rest of us. Rock solid feature. Sentimental Value is a lot of fun. Would recommend. Check it out in theaters if you can. I know it's a limited selection. It should make it around somewhere. And being Neon, it's not actually A24. Neon put it out, so I don't know what streamer it's going to. Maybe HBO? It'd fit on HBO. I don't know where it'll end up, but if you have the ability, go check it out in theaters. That's Sentimental Value. Man, that is episode 317 of the podcast. Woo! I don't know how we do it. Andy, what are we watching next week?
So next week, December 9th, we're going to be taking a look at Hamnet, which is the new Chloe Zhao film starring Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal that has been raved about. People talking Best Picture, Best Actor kind of nominations. So that is out in theaters this Friday, December 5th. So we'll be taking a look at that. And Jay Kelly, which is a new Netflix film from writer-director Noah Baumbach, starring George Clooney and Adam Sandler, where he plays a bit like himself, an aging movie star in his twilight years. Some parallels to Sentimental Value, honestly, in a lot of ways. I heard good things and also heard some mixed things, so we're going to be checking that out. Some FYI releases. Five Nights at Freddy's 2 opens this weekend if you're interested in that. Jujutsu Kaisen Execution, new anime film. We got to start reporting on this because they're so successful.
Dude.
And 100 Nights of Hero, which is kind of a medieval rom-com starring Michael Monroe, is also out. I don't know if that's out wide, but for next week, Hamnet and Jay Kelly.
Oh yeah, 100 Nights of Heroes also got He-Man.
Nicholas Galitzin.
Nicholas Galitzin is in it. Yeah, that's his thing before. Yeah, okay. If you enjoyed the podcast today, if you like what we're doing here in Off-Script Film Review, the best way to support us here on the show is just subscribe on whatever platform you're currently engaging with us on. If you're on YouTube, subscribe on YouTube. If you're one of our audio listeners on Spotify, Google Play, iTunes, iHeartMedia, hit the sub button over there. Leave a comment if you can. A rating and review helps out a ton as well. Helps push us up in the almighty algorithm in the sky. I'm not really sure how it works, to be completely honest with you, but you can check out our individual reviews on YouTube. We're on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, all the usual social media places. You can check out our website, offscriptfilmreview.com, for more. And you can write into the show direct. Maybe send us a review, a little like Eternity, huh? At mail@offscriptfilmreview.com. From all of us at Offscript, thank you, Chris, for writing into the show. And I don't know. That's Offscript episode 317. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Thanks for watching.